Hello, everyone. That's a loud microphone today. We're going to go ahead and get started. I know a lot of people are being delayed by the weather, but we'll just go ahead and get started. We'd like to welcome everyone today to the Alaska World Affairs Council. My name is Lisa Falsko, CEO of the World Affairs Council, and it's such a pleasure to have our speaker and program here for all of you today. This program is being recorded for the radio, so if you have a cell phone, if you wouldn't mind turning that off so our radio listeners don't hear your ringtone. We do like them, but if you could just take a moment to turn that off, it'd be great. And then during our question and answer period, if you could wait for the microphone, that will also be helpful for our radio listeners. I'm not going to spend a lot of time up here at the microphone today, but I do want to mention a couple of things. One is we have the Student World Quest competition coming up in February. So for all the students or anyone who knows a student, have them go to our website and get information about this. The winning team of four gets sent to Washington, D.C. to compete nationally, and Alaska has done very well for the last couple of years. So please consider joining us or supporting us or sending your students. It's a great event. And this year, we are for the first time starting a pub trivia contest for all of you adults out there who want to play along. That's in January, January 16th, and there are information cards on your table. So if you're interested in that, please consider joining us, and we'll have fun topics like economics, culinary, paparazzi, geography, something for everyone. It'll be a great time. I don't know if there's any students here today. I know it is finals week, but I'd like to thank BP so much for sponsoring our student program, as well as I know they're a big sponsor of the Olympics, and they make it possible for students to come to our program at no cost. So thank you very much to BP. And I also noticed in our audience, we have the pleasure of having Mayor Dan Sullivan with us, and I'd like to bring him to the podium. I just asked him off the fly, but it would be such a great pleasure to have him talk a little bit about Alaska's bid for the Olympics and where we stand.
Well, thank you very much, and we were excited to come to lunch today because we knew what the presentation was going to be about, and it is very exciting to have people not only at the head table but in the audience today that have participated in the Olympics in one form or another. And it really is something that for Anchorage, people sometimes forget that we had the United States bid in both 92 and 94 to compete on the international level to host the Olympic Winter Games. And we came in really close second in the first round of balloting in 94. And here we are, you know, almost 30 years later. And we just got to thinking, you know, if we're a bigger, stronger, more capable city, we've held many, many national and international scope events, and it might be appropriate for us to see if the U.S. Olympic Committee would again consider Anchorage as a possible host city. And so we've formed an exploratory committee, which is really just doing a kind of a cursory overview of our facilities, our capabilities, whether or not the marketing advantage that we clearly shared back in the early 90s is still as viable. And so some of the members of the exploratory committee are here today. I won't name everybody. Just go ahead and stand up, guys. And Susan Duck, who's heading up the exploratory committee. And yeah, thank you for coming. And the so we hope by March, when the Sochi Games have concluded, that we will have a report that will give us some guidance going forward on whether to truly pursue the games or not. It'd be 2026, so it's 13 years away, and it seems like a long time off, but it really does take a decade plus of preparation to do it right. So we're going to put our best foot forward if in March the group decides that this is worth pursuing. So you'll hear much more about it over the months to come, and we hope that it'll be the kind of event that will literally galvanize not only the whole community but the whole state, because it truly would be a statewide event. So again, thank you for giving me an opportunity to give a quick update, and stay tuned. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Mayor Sullivan. And I'd like to introduce our head table. To my far left, it has my great pleasure to introduce Mr. Dr. Paul Dunscombe, who's been on our board several years and is back, and we are so thrilled to have him join us again at the head table. And to his right, Rosie Fletcher, snowboarding medalist, who will come to the podium and introduce our speaker. Rosie.
Thank you, and thanks for everybody for coming out today. I know the weather is I'm happy it's snowing, but it's still a little bit challenging in the car. I have to tell you, with less than 100 days left until Sochi, I am really nervous. I am more nervous now to watch the Alaskans compete than I ever was in my three times at the Olympics. And I think it's going to be exciting. We have so many athletes from so many different sports, figure skating, curling, cross-country skiing, alpine skiing, snowboarding, hockey. I mean, we have a lot of really talented athletes, and our field is very deep, so it's going to be really exciting. I would also like to recognize James Southam, who just stood up. He's on the exploratory committee, but he's also one of our Alaskan Olympians. Thanks for coming, James. To win an Olympic medal, a gold medal, is exciting. But to carry the torch is also a really great honor. And I think today's speech is going to be incredible. I think that Pat's going to, I see that she brought her medal. And I think it's going to be really fascinating to hear about her adventures. Pat is Vice Chancellor for Administrative Services at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and Vice President of Finance for the University of the Arctic. Before moving to Alaska, Pat is from Billings, Montana. She competed as a member of the U.S. shooting team, winning an Olympic gold medal in women's air rifle in the 1984 Olympics in L.A. Also while attending Murray State University in Kentucky in the 1980s, the team won two NCAA national championships, and Pat was an All-American and won two individual national titles. Pat moved to Fairbanks in 1987, earned an MBA from UAF, and has worked with the University of Alaska since 1991. This year was a highlight as she was inducted into the U.S. Shooting Hall of Fame and was selected to represent the U.S. for the Sochi Winter Olympic Games torch run in the North Pole. The North Pole torch run promoted the Olympic spirit, but also highlighted Arctic cooperation with all eight Arctic nations participating in this historic event. She is here today to speak to us on Making the Golden Connection, an Olympian's experience carrying the torch to the North Pole. Please join me in welcoming Pat Pitney to the podium.
Thank you, Rosie. It's amazing that, you know, we've both been in the state for a really long time, and this is our first time we've had an opportunity to meet. I wanted to introduce a few people in the audience that joined me. My daughter, Crystal Pitney, my daughter, Kimberly Pitney Seitz, and her husband, Andrew Seitz. So this was a huge honor to be selected, and it actually had a lot more to do with my work with the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the University of the Arctic than it had to do with the gold medal. It was just serendipitous that they went along, and it bumped my chances of being able to go. So that my talk will be a little bit more about kind of the Arctic theme of the North Pole, but spattered with some of the Olympic tradition and the excitement that existed on that trip to the North Pole because of the tradition of the torch. So with that, some credit to the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the University of the Arctic. So you would think that a North Pole expedition would look more like this. This is Nansen in the ice. And in fact, you might, that's 100 years ago, and you would think, well, maybe it's more like 20 years ago here. Oh, I'm sorry, I can't find the little button. How about we try the play button here? So watch the guy in the front. But this was just 20 years ago, what it might have looked like to be on the North Pole. But I would have to say that we did it the right way. I'll go back here. So this is just a kind of a preview of how we got to the North Pole. So we were on the Russian icebreaker called the 50 Years of Victory. And there were a huge send-off in Murmansk, Russia with a military band. And what they took very seriously and what created a tremendous amount of excitement on the trip was the fact that they were carrying the Olympic flame. And they took the tradition and the protocol of the Olympic flame very seriously, but it really transformed the attitude of the people on the ship and the seriousness and the excitement that that we were all honored to be part of this torch run. And the you just saw the little birdcage that they call it. They protected the flame in, and it's very serious, the tradition of the Olympic flame. And they went to Greece and picked up the Olympic flame. So anybody involved in the Olympic bid, if Anchorage gets it, be thinking there's a trip to Greece to collect the Olympic flame at the beginning. And then there's the message of the torch run around the country. And Russia, by far, has had the most extravagant Olympic torch run ever. After we went to the North Pole with the torch, then they went into space with the torch, and then they took the torch to the bottom of Lake Baikal. They had 14,000 people were able to carry the torch, and I assumed that the torch went from person to person, but lo and behold, everybody has a torch, and you just light the next person's torch. And so up at the front of the room is the torch that I was able to carry, and everybody at the end of the program are welcome to look at it. But that the excitement of the torch run was important, but the other piece that everyone on the ship took very seriously was the concept of Arctic cooperation. They invited a guest from each of the Arctic nations to carry the torch, and Russia's taking the Arctic very seriously. They're in the Arctic every day. This trip to the North Pole, although it was a once-in-a-lifetime thing for me, they went there five times this summer on this same ship on a cruise. They took tourists on this ship to the North Pole. In April, they put a temporary runway in, and they do North Pole tours via skiing and snow machine and dog sled. So they are, I mean, the North Pole in Russia it's accessible. It's part of, you know, what they're doing. It's part of how they do business and how they celebrate their Arctic nation pride. But the nice part was they invited the rest of the Arctic nations because they know they can't be in the Arctic alone. The Arctic has got its harsh conditions and they need everybody engaged in it. So how come it stopped here? Maybe we finished already. I'll go to the next one. So we'll go here. So our route, if you're not familiar with this map from the top of the world, we started in Murmansk, Russia, up on the far right, and that little red line was our trip into the North Pole, and the only land we saw was Franz Josef Land, the islands. And you can see Greenland there and Alaska, and then Canada's on the other opposite side from Greenland. So this was a common view, a common map view of the Arctic. And we just got on the ship there in Murmansk, a relatively large community in the very north. At its peak, about 500,000 people. Right now, there's only about 300,000 people that live there. But got on the ship, and 92 hours later, showed up on the North Pole. And literally on the North Pole, 90 degrees north, we went up and parked, and there was a big celebration on the bridge of the ship. And so what did we do? In total, we were on the ship for 10 days. We had everybody that was involved did a lecture. So sometimes there was two or three lectures a day. The people that were involved took it seriously, and these are some lectures. And the lectures took a little bit longer because there were Russians, and then there were about 11 of us that were foreigners. So they would translate everything. And if it was a Russian speaker, then we would have one translator sit with us, and he'd communicate in the back of the room. It would be quicker. But when we were speaking, the translation took a little bit longer. Eating took a lot of time. I mean, everybody assumed that they were going to be bored. They brought books and movies and so forth. But, you know, at 8:30, there was breakfast, and at 1:30, there was lunch, and at 4:30, there was snack, and then at 7:30, there was dinner. And this wasn't just normal stuff. This was, you know, four-course dinners and three-course lunches and, I mean, fabulous food. So, again, a really harsh trip to the North Pole here. Yeah, somebody had to do it. So, and this is our table of folks. So as a celebration after reaching the North Pole, we had dinner in the captain's quarters, and this was our group in the captain's quarters. And then, of course, we had always had these great entertainment. Not only did we have a singer, whoops, I turned my sound off, sorry. He was quite a good singer. But we had singers, we had dancers. There was a young rock band group that came along. And then there was, you know, the normal piano player. And so there was entertainment. I don't know, six of the 10 days that we were on that we had entertainment. As I mentioned, it was about Arctic cooperation. And the Russians did a fabulous job. So the torch run, and again, remember, if we get the torch, this is important. The torch run really is creating pride and excitement for the upcoming Olympic Games. And they send the torch around the country. Well, so much of that pride is about building the pride in the country and giving the country some buy-in to the Olympic Games, because sometimes that's, you know, as close as you get, and many countries don't have the opportunity to present the Olympic Games. But what they did on this trip was not focus on Russia, but focused on the importance of the Arctic cooperation and inviting foreigners to carry the torch as part of their piece was really a big credit, I think, to the message that they have for the Arctic. Here's another picture of us on the ice when the cauldron was lit. Each of the nations were there. All of the nations, with the exception of Canada, where Canada was represented by an Olympic skier, Steve Podborski. You probably know Steve. besides that, all the other torchbearers were somehow related to the University of the Arctic, and the University of the Arctic is this consortium of higher education institutions across the North. And each has a higher education bent, whether it be climate change, whether it be geopolitics in the Arctic, oceanography, geology of the Arctic. Everybody had an interest in the North and was connected to this network. And it does show the influence of the higher education leaders in their country when Elena, the smaller lady in the middle, was part of, she was essentially the selection committee for who represented the Arctic and was recognized by the Russian government to influence those individuals selected. And that's exactly why I was selected to go. It actually, our Chancellor Rogers, who serves on the board of the University of the Arctic with Elena, was actually first selected, and he, had too much stuff to do on his calendar. And I'm like, I could do that. And he thought that was appropriate, and of course let me take the time. So it was a strengthening of that network as well between the various individuals. And who were our hosts? So up in the top left, the host was the company Ross Atom. And Ross Atoms is a huge international nuclear company. They have over 270,000 employees worldwide, primarily in Russia. They provide 40% of the energy in Russia. But the Rosatom Flot is a ship company that's part of Rosatom. And it's a partially owned company of Russia, the Russian government, but runs as a private organization. About 30% of their revenue comes from the Russian government. But they were the sponsors. And so this is the head of the Rosatom Flot. They have a fleet of icebreakers, and they're nuclear icebreakers. And I must say, they're impressive ships with tremendous power. And they do not feel at all bound by where they can go in the Arctic with these ships. They can go anywhere at any time. This is the first time they went to the North Pole in the polar night, where it was always all dark. They go in the summer all the time. It's the first time they went in the dark. We were 4 hours short of the fastest time getting to the North Pole. We averaged 15 knots from Murmansk all the way through the ice to the North Pole. But that company is a huge company. They're proud of their company. Their safety standards are high. They're very professional. And they'll do business here. I mean, if you need an icebreaker, call them up. They want to come. They're building new icebreakers coming soon. The person on the top right, his name is Viktor Byorsky. He's a polar adventurer. So the film I showed at the beginning, that was Viktor at the very front of the team where they transversed Antarctica through the South Pole with an international team, and a man named Will Steger from the United States was part of that international group. He builds a temporary runway in April and brings people to the North Pole via, you know, a little era type jet. They fly up there, they come on this temporary runway, and they stay for whether it be 2 days or 3 weeks. But he takes 5 weeks in that April time frame and builds a runway every year and does tours. In 1989, when he left on his south the Antarctic trip, He left as a Soviet Union citizen and came back as a Russian citizen. He said he had more access to news in Antarctica than he felt like he would have had in St. Petersburg. But he didn't speak English before that trip. And now he was our primary interpreter on this trip. Then Arthur Chilingarov, his title, he's on the bottom left. His title is Russian Hero, and also a polar explorer. What gave him his polar title was he was stationed as part of the military service for the Soviet Union on ice floes in the north. And they would put a military camp on an ice floe that would float across the North Atlantic. And so they could get very close to things, and nobody would know where they were at, and they... You know, radar didn't get them because they were there. And they ran those floating stations, I think, until the early 70s before they start doing them. But he's also, has speed dial to Putin, super influential. He chartered a jet out of Murmansk because he didn't want to wait for the commercial airline opening up. We got there early. Fortunately, he let 30 people join him, and so I was able to get back to Moscow on Friday instead of what would have been Monday by the time I could get a commercial flight. So that was very nice. But he more than, I believe it's his leadership that's saying we've got to, every Arctic nation has to be ready for the opening up of the Arctic. On the bottom right is the Olympic Committee team. They are the organizers of the Torch Run. They were who we corresponded with, a very energetic group, very professional group, and it's to their credit that there was such good coverage of the event. So again, the ship, it's massive and powerful. So I'm one of my UAF hat. One of my highest priorities is to get our heat and power plant for the university campus replaced. It's 50 years old, and it's a 17 megawatt heat and power plant. It will heat 3 million square feet of facilities throughout the campus in Fairbanks, Alaska, and provide all the electricity. So 17 megawatts, that's the power plant we're putting in, or replacing. 54,000 megawatts of power. There was no question where you could go. The average 15 knots from Murmansk to the North Pole, that's faster than our exciting and new and what's going to be a tremendous ship, the Sukhuliak, our Arctic research vessel that we're the stewards of for the National Science Foundation that'll be in Seward here coming in a year. It's faster than the Sukhuliak will ever go. Sukhuliak's max speed is 14 knots. So tremendous power. And again, they don't feel locked about where they can go and who they can help get through the Arctic. So let's see if this one works. It's a little demonstration of it going through the... So this is just right before we got to the North Pole. It was the morning. We got there at noon. This was in the morning.
Les 7 mois passés sur la glace nous ont coupé du monde. Même le regard de la caméra devait...
So, the amount of ice it'll go through is about 2.5 meters. But occasionally, I mean, there was a lot of white noise and just a lot of scratching noise. And occasionally the ship would kind of bump or shake, but not like it would knock you over. It was just like, oh, you know, kind of like an earthquake here. Really, you know, really short earthquake. That's what it felt like. But that was it. The rest of the time you just sailed through. This is their next version. They're going to have another one ready in 2017. Ross Adam Flott has right now 6 of the larger ships, and they have several smaller ships, not all nuclear. And Russia's investing in these icebreakers because it's going to make a huge difference in trade. For taking oil and gas from Murmansk to the Asian markets, you save 19 days. So a little bit about the fuel on these icebreakers. It uses 120 grams of uranium a day, so a small handful. When they fill up the fuel for these ships, they fill it up for 5 years. So they can go and go and go. I mean, it's more food that's going to stop them than it is the fuel. But it saves 19 days from Murmansk to the Asian markets if you go across the Northern Sea Route versus going through the Suez Canal. You can get bigger ships through on the Northern Sea Route. For goods and service, goods going from Rotterdam, general European port, to Japan, it saves 10 days. It's, you know, easily $200,000 on one shipment across between the Suez Canal versus going across the North Slope. That's why they're in the business. They're preparing, they're ready. And it's, and again, one of the reporters from Murmansk asked, why isn't the United States in the Arctic? I said, Alaska's excited about the Arctic. We're the only Arctic state. And I said, it's got to be when they see the commercial viability. Well, the commercial viability is around the corner. Part of the commercial viability is, do we have the policies? Do we have the ports? Do we have the rescue structure in place that's going to make this worthwhile? But it's coming, so we can either be in the game or it'll pass us by. Because if you have a ship that can go for years, they can pass by any Alaska port ever. If we want to take advantage of it, we probably ought to have some infrastructure, both from a safety perspective, but also from a trade perspective. So really that comes down to, what does it mean? And so how can Alaska be part of the solution? How can we be prepared for some of our destiny? What does it mean to the United States? The United States doesn't really believe itself as an Arctic nation. And what role does Alaska have in letting the United States know we are an Arctic nation, and not only is it good for Alaska, it's good for the entire United States to be ready for the Arctic opening. And what does it mean for the Arctic? The other big thing about the people that were there is everyone in one context or another talked about the value of the environment in the Arctic and the fragility of the environment. And so even though they're running a nuclear ship through there, they understand the responsibility they have to protect a really unique environment. And the world, the whole world's going to be up north here before too long. We all ought to be ready for it. So with that, I can take questions varying from my experience in 1984 when I was a mere child, younger than my children now, all the way through the University of the Arctic, through this trip. It was a fabulous honor to be able to go, and I noticed Vic Fisher back there in the audience. We tried very hard to get Vic to go, but it was a last-minute deal. Literally, I got my visa on Friday. I got an announcement on Wednesday. We had to show up on Sunday to be able to catch the ship. I got my visa on Friday when we had to show up on Sunday, and on Wednesday when we finally got it, it was too late. And otherwise, it would have been fabulous to have Vic with his Russian experience on board and learn from him. So thank you for coming, Vic, and I'm really sorry it didn't work out. So, thank you.
So before Pat takes questions, just want to remind folks that since we are recording for broadcast, if you could wait for the microphone to reach you. So we have,
What was the noise like down below as you were breaking through the ice? I've heard in the Cook Inlet when the ice flow goes back and forth with the tide, it's incredible noise as it goes up and down against the platforms. And what was it like, the noise basically? Was it insulated or was it just a tremendous sound of crashing the whole time?
It was pretty insulated. It was more like this white, kind of a, you know, there's just more of a whir and a, you know, an occasional knock, but it wasn't. Earplugs were fine for sleeping. I did use earplugs though, all right? But it wasn't horrible. It was more like this kind of a higher level of white noise. So
Pat, what's the politics and the economic logistics of the U.S. building icebreakers like Russia's building now?
Well, among all of the Arctic nations, it's perceived that the U.S. is absent as an Arctic nation. I mean, this is Finland and Sweden and Norway and not so much Iceland, but Denmark. Denmark has more presence really in the Arctic than the United States. So they do view the United States as this major power. And as an Olympic athlete, all right, no matter what, the United States is the best place by far on Earth, and the Soviet Union is this, you gotta beat the Soviet Union, and now it's Russia, and you gotta beat Russia and anybody in the Eastern Bloc. But I gotta tell you, they got us beat on this this Arctic Traveler and the Icebreaker piece. They're way ahead of us. They're way ahead in their conscious development of northern communities. But in terms of the politics, you know, we're a capitalist nation. It's got to be, you know, it's got to be market viable. But then there's also the Coast Guard and the general national security that's out there. And so in terms of the politics, it's getting the nation to recognize there's potential in the Arctic and it's a worthwhile investment. I don't think there's any, it's a peaceful place, you know, of all places that that we can develop infrastructure and protect infrastructure. Everybody agrees it's peaceful. It's just not worth it in the Arctic to create anything but peace. And the nations that are participating believe it's peaceful. So I think it's just a matter of communicating and what role does Alaska want to take in communicating the importance of the Arctic to the rest of the nation, because it's not going to be just the Alaska investment. We'll have to do our own investment, but hopefully the nation will invest as well.
Thank you, Pat, and congratulations on the achievement and to the University of the Arctic for its representation. I wanted to go back and ask a question about the ice flows, and it looked like from your pictures that when you left Murmansk, it was ice-free. But by the time you got to the North Pole, there obviously was ice conditions. Mm-hmm. And so could you talk a little bit about, in the context of a warming Arctic, what the ice conditions itself were like, either thickness or otherwise?
So the one little movie clip that I showed where the ice was coming up on the side of the ship, that's as thick as we saw the ice. And in fact, when we got to the North Pole, literally they parked at the North Pole and there was this huge party on the bridge. It was great. So that was like at noon. And then they had to actually drive around off of the North Pole to find ice that was solid enough for them to park so that we could do the torch run get out on the ice and do the presentation out on the ice. And the comments, well, we made it in 92 hours, okay, and this was not like a speed tour. We were expecting 2 weeks. We were done in 10 days. 92 hours, the fastest they've ever made it was 88 hours. They were astonished. I mean, they knew September's the lowest ice period ever. They kind of stop going when it starts getting dark. But they were astonished by the lack of ice. But they're also, you know, they're going through there taking shipments and of oil and gas and goods across on a regular basis. Not so much after, September, October, but starting in April all the way through. So they were astonished by the amount of ice and that we couldn't just pull up on the North Pole and park was pretty amazing too.
Hi, Pat. Great talk, by the way.
Thank you.
While you were there with the folks from Ross Flot, and you know they're closely aligned with Rosneft, do they talk a little bit about their plans to explore the OCS or to start oil exploration in the Arctic in the north? Did you get any indication of what they're looking to do there?
You know, they didn't talk a lot about that. All they did was they talked about being prepared to support any development and any trade routes that wanted to go, that you needed a ship to be your icebreaker so you could follow along. We're there. If you need a ship that can break ice and carry stuff, they'd be there. So it was more, there's industry and trade that's going to happen. We'll have the ships ready for you. Yeah, it's much more that type of an attitude.
Thank you very much for talk about unity of Arctic. There's a good number of indigenous population in Arctic. Could you tell us about the indigenous participation of this project?
So I would say on the project, not a tremendous amount. I will say with the University of the Arctic, one of their primary values is giving voice to the indigenous communities and people of the North. And part of the University of the Arctic is knowledge in the North, but by the Northerners, so that the policy changes aren't coming and being imposed from the South, where people aren't living in the North every day. They're not seeing, you know, what it takes to sustain. They don't have the culture of the indigenous populations and communities. But I would say the seven other Arctic nations have much higher respect for indigenous population than Russia. And so Russia has a very much of a planned northern community development that's less inclusive of the traditional ways than the other nations. So.
Very educational. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've got a couple questions that you probably already answered. The Northern Sea Route, say to Japan, as opposed to the traditional way through the canal and by Singapore and that, how much time? How many days did they knock off?
So from Murmansk to Japan, which was the maximum one, was 19 days. So in that, and Murmansk is focused on oil and gas. So taking oil and gas across. So from Rotterdam, which would be a more European port, it's 10 days savings. But 10 days is in the range of $200,000 for one transit.
They save?
They save.
You said the average 15 knots on your trip. That's impressive, but in the thickest ice, did they say how fast they were going when they were?
So when we were actually moving, there were times when the ship was only going two, but they weren't actually trying to move. Uh-huh. But when we were hitting the roughest ice, we were at 9, 10 knots, and the maximum was just over 20. So we were traveling fast most of the time when the ship was like, it was like 21 and a half knots was their max on the ship. So. Right. Thank you.
So, well, thanks very much to Pat Pittman for coming and addressing us. And unless I'm mistaken, UAF would also be hosting a Model Arctic Council sometime in the spring?
Actually, it's UAF, through our partnership in the University of the Arctic, UAF is sending people to a Model Arctic Council, but it's in conjunction with the Northern Arctic Federal University in Arkhangelsk, Russia.
And certainly that will be helpful, I think, in spreading the word on the importance of the Arctic. So we thank you very much for your speech today, and I'm very pleased to present you with this.
I think that's
right. Oops. There it is. Sorry. To present you with this lovely gift.
Thank you
very much. So, Alaska World Affairs Council is a membership organization, and if you are not yet members of the Alaska World Affairs Council but would be interested in doing so, on the center of your tables you'll find a blue membership card. So if you're interested, please, by all means, pick up one of those. And consider joining us for our many upcoming programs in the new year. And in particular, give some thought to the possibility of World Quest, which takes place on February 1st, or in preparation for that, the World Whiz pub trivia on January 16th. Hope to see you there. We have further information on events at the front desk. It always helps if you can RSVP for these events, and you can find out more on our website or on our Facebook page. And on your way out, if you would care to recycle your name tags for next time, by all means, leave them at the desk. And I believe that concludes our program for 2013. And look forward to seeing everyone in 2014. Have a lovely holiday. So take care.
And